Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD, and I want to welcome everyone to the program today. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with Larice. I call her Reese for short, and we're going to be talking about mindfulness and nutrition and how that relates to ADHD. But before I get Reese on the phone, a couple of things. For those of you who are in the Los Angeles area, I want to invite you to our adult support group that I run for CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD, and it's every Wednesday night at the Center for Learning Unlimited. Address is 2785 Pacific Coast Highway in Torrance, and it's 7:30 to 9 on Wednesday nights. And we have a lot of growth going on in that group and a lot of fun, and we'd love to see you there. Last week we had Alan Brown from ADD Crusher. Everybody really enjoyed him. Alan, I really want to thank you again for coming and speaking to everyone. This is a little off what we're doing today, but I was wondering if anybody's listening up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My two sons, Mike and Chris, who have been on my podcast, Chris, my older son with bipolar 2 and ADHD, and Mike with ADHD and the autistic spectrum, they're looking for an apartment. They're having a hard time. They had two locked up, and at the last minute, somebody outbid them. They need to be in by March 1st. So if anybody knows of anything, if you could contact me, I would really appreciate that. Try to help them hear from Los Angeles. They're doing a great job. But those of anyone looking for tenants, they need a three-bedroom because there's going to be three guys up there. Please contact me on my Facebook page, which is Miss ADD, or on my website, or you can call me directly, 310-735-5874. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate you trying to help me with that. So I'm going to have Reese get on the phone now. Hi, Reese.
Hello, Justine.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So Reese is not only a member of my adult support group, but she's also a coaching client of mine. And we've been together how long now?
About a year and a half, maybe?
Yes, probably a year and a half, yes. And Reese has done a tremendous amount of work on herself and has had a tremendous amount of growth. Amazing.
Yes.
And so I was wondering if maybe you could just tell everyone out there a little bit about, you know, yourself, your childhood, your adolescent years, and how ultimately you came to understand that you had ADD, because you didn't before that.
Okay. Well, thank you for asking me to come here today. You caught
my pleasure.
Caught me on a good day, so that's a good thing. Okay, so my childhood, my parents divorced when I was two, and so I was raised by my mother alone. I didn't even meet my father until about 2010, so I had very little contact with him or any of his family.
Okay.
While I was growing up. So it was just my mom and I. She never had any other children, so I was an only child raised by a single parent. Originally, we lived with my grandmother, and I feel like that is where I got a lot of my good foundation,
okay.
I would say.
Okay.
She was probably the most stable force in my life until about the age 11 when she passed away.
Oh. This is your mom's mom.
My mom's mother, yes. And I did, as I was telling you the other day, I did have a good male role model in my life, who was my uncle, was my aunt, my mom's sister's husband.
Right.
And that relationship with him was good for me. He was a good male role model. Even though I understood it wasn't my dad, I did have a good male role model in my life. I think at about the age 7, and I think it was at 7 because that was when my mom and I lived alone for the first time, that is when I pretty much stopped growing emotionally or maturing emotionally. And it's also when my food addiction developed.
Wow, okay.
And who knows, maybe even just the absence of my grandmother.
Right.
That
sorrow.
Yeah, brought on that. And then I realized, you know, I could temporarily fill myself with food to kind of get over pain and suffering or whatever. Not having my dad around was very difficult for me really early on. And I knew that, like I knew that not having my dad here was not good for me,
right,
even at an early age. I did fairly well in school. When I actually did the work, I did good. I never had a problem really comprehending academically.
Okay.
But I had very little interest. School was very social to me, and I was a social misfit.
Well, I think you were also very creative.
Yes.
So the boring, mundane subject.
Very boring.
Right.
Yeah. But okay, if I actually did it, I did fairly well. I got A's and B's. But going to school was difficult for me. Number one, I was teased and bullied. I had psoriasis. I was born with it.
Wow.
And it covered about 85% of my body. It's a skin
right
disorder. It's actually a blood disorder, but it manifests on the skin. I was about 20 pounds overweight. We didn't have a lot of money, so there were even times where I went to school with clothes that had holes.
Wow.
And so kids made fun of me. Yeah, and my mom always tried to help by saying, it's because you're so pretty. You know, they're
right,
jealous.
Right.
The boys like you, that's how they say it, and the right girls are jealous because you're so pretty, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I was really shy, which is obviously not who I am anymore.
No, you're not shy anymore.
But I was very shy, and so I didn't make friends easily. So school was difficult, the social part of it. And growing up in my house was challenging for me. Because my mom was raising me on her own, I stepped in kind of as her partner as opposed to the parent-child.
You were parentified.
Parentified,
at a very young age. You became the parent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, I was a latchkey kid at 7, so walking home from school and taking care of things from second grade on. My mom cooked early on still, but, you know, I'd come home to an empty house most of the time.
She was hard.
Had to do, you know, be responsible for doing my homework and bathing and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And my mom would try to take me to work as much as possible, but because of her business,
right,
it wasn't always, you know,
easy for her to do.
Correct.
Right.
So she did keep us in safe neighborhoods, though, and I think because she knew that
right
I was going to be spending a lot of time home alone.
Right.
But that was hard for me, so I was immature but forced to be responsible.
Right.
Which was difficult.
Was there, as you look back now, was there resentment?
Tons of resentment.
Okay.
Which is, I didn't know it was resentment at the time. It's only now looking back that I realize it was resentment.
Okay.
I really thought that all of my anger stemmed from my dad not being there and that I was angry at my dad.
Right.
I didn't realize that I did have resentment towards my mom. And maybe I didn't even want to admit that because she was there.
Right.
And I saw how that she, you know, she worked. She worked hard. And she did always work hard. But, you know, I always felt in competition with her job because I was like, it was bad enough that my dad wasn't there. I wanted my mom there too.
Right.
So I think that once I hit preteen, I came up with the idea, maybe I got it from my peers, that if I acted out, I could get the attention that I needed.
And did you?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, I went above and beyond because, you know what, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right.
And, or to an extreme.
Oh, always an extreme, yes. Right. I'm all in or nothing.
Right.
So, I mean, I got into a lot of trouble very early on. It started about 12. I started smoking weed. I tried acid for the first time.
Age 12?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I had already, you know, dabbled with alcohol. By age 13, I was using crystal meth and became
Whoa.
Sexually active.
Wow.
With guys that were, you know, adults, 18 to early 20s.
Wow, that's very difficult.
Yeah, and by the time I was 15, I had been using meth for about a year, year and a half, so my body was chemically addicted.
Wow.
So I had to, you know,
detox.
Fight that, yes.
How did you get off crystal meth?
Well, okay, the leeway story is I had met my ex-husband, my boyfriend at the time, when I was 14, and he was in trouble with the law, and he was living in a very dysfunctional home, and he was also using drugs. And we had been dating for about 6 months. He was on probation, and he went to court, and the judge said, you're not doing what I told you to do, and you're going to jail. And took him to, like, a juvenile hall or, like a youth prison.
Okay.
And he was there for about 4 or 5 months. Well, I was in the midst of being in love. I was horrified, and I vowed to do everything I possibly could to make the changes necessary so that when he got home and we were together, that we would never be apart again.
Wow.
And
at that young age.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And
so your need for connection
was motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I continued to use drugs while he was there in jail. And when he got out, I stopped. We both stopped.
Wow.
I kind of drug him along with me. It was like, this is my plan. This is what we're going to do. Do you want to join in? And he was like, yeah, sure, okay.
So he would do anything that
yeah.
you said at that point. Yeah.
So, you know, I there's a saying, you have people in your life, even if it's just for a short time for a specific reason, there's something like that.
Yeah.
And I do feel, even though ultimately our marriage did not work out, we needed each other at that moment.
Yes.
He started going to school. He eventually got off probation. We both stopped using drugs. We both found, at the time, religion, which developed into our spiritual life.
Right.
We both went back to school. And we were headed down a really, really bad path of drug use. And a lot of our friends that we were friends with at that time are either dead from overdosing, in prison, or have huge criminal records to the point where it still affects their lives now.
Wow.
So, I mean, we needed each other.
Right.
You know, we depended a lot on each other to kind of get through that. So that is ultimately how I stopped using drugs.
Okay. And yeah. then I guess you once told me that you and your boyfriend, soon to be your husband, moved in with your mom.
Yeah, he was in living in the LA Unified School District, and at the time he had been expelled from the school district. And so he couldn't get into any schools. And part of his probation was that he had to be in school. So we had convinced our parents that if he could come and stay with us, my mom and I, then he could go to school in our district. And
which
then he would be
Torrance.
Mm-hmm. So that was initially, which, I mean, that was the real reason. It wasn't like we made up a story. That
right.
was the real reason, was to get him in school. And that was when we were 16.
Wow.
And he stayed with us. Yeah. And we ended up getting married. I was 18. It was just before my 19th birthday. We got married, and we stayed and lived with my mom until we were about 24. And then we got our own place.
And what was that like? You know, I guess before you answer that question, I do know something about you that I think the audience would be interested in hearing, and that is, for the longest time, excuse me, you were kind of against diagnosis of anything.
Mm-hmm. And against prescription drugs. I won't say who, because I don't think it's fair, but there were people in my life that had addictions
mm-hmm.
to prescription medication.
Right.
But because it was prescribed by a doctor,
then it's okay.
Yes.
Right.
That was the attitude they had. And to me, especially as an addict, I mean, I have an addicted personality. I've struggled with many addictions throughout my life. I know that how easy it is for me. So I strayed away. I mean, I stayed away
okay.
from things that I thought were considered drugs. And to me, just because a doctor says you should take this, it was a drug. And I did not want to be a part of that.
Okay.
And I felt that by taking it, then I was saying it's okay for these other people in my life at the time that were taking prescription drugs and abusing them.
Okay. But as you look back, you believe that you had been depressed all along.
Yeah, I feel, in looking back, my depression started at the same time my food addiction did, about age 7.
Okay.
And it's now that I know I was depressed, I can, I see so many things in my life why they were occurring. It was because of my depression.
Right.
And I didn't understand. I don't know, maybe I didn't really know what depression was.
No, a lot of people don't.
Okay, and
right.
I think that I just didn't ever feel like that was me. I don't know. I can't make the correlation, but no, I did not know I was depressed, and I probably, if someone had even mentioned the idea to me, I probably would have been in denial about it.
You know, I just want to digress for a minute because I think this is an important point. For myself, like you, I didn't know that I was depressed, and as I look back on my childhood, I too had depression from a young age. So the signs of depression are not necessarily what people think,
mm-hmm.
that you're crying all the time,
mm-hmm.
that you can't get out of bed, that you either can't eat or you overeat. There are other signs of a dysthymic disorder, which is a chronic depression, and that could manifest itself in low frustration tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know for myself when I was early on as a parent, having two children with ADD, it was very difficult at times to really regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so between ADD and depression, that became an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there's symptoms of depression that you just don't feel like having fun. Things that were normally fun aren't fun. You know, what I just said about low frustration tolerance.
Isolation.
The other thing is you just kind of, you can't focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't feel like you want to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And this is even above and beyond ADD. So I just thought I'd add that in.
I'm glad that you did, because I think that people don't understand depression.
No.
And when I tell people I'm depressed, sometimes they're like, they look at me like, what? Really? You?
Right.
Because I am naturally, I'm a pretty positive
yes.
person. I'm upbeat. I'm friendly.
Yes.
Even if I'm sad, I almost always have a smile on my face, or I can engage and have normal discussions with people. So people, you know, I think they have an idea or an image of what depression looks like, and
right.
because I didn't fit that, I didn't get a lot of sympathy. I didn't have an understanding. No one ever really talked to me about it, so
right.
I had no idea what was going on.
And the other misnomer is, because I, too, have an eating disorder, and at one time in my life was 300 pounds, so I can relate to what you went through. What I noticed is that people just kind of made fun of me
mm-hmm.
for being overweight. People don't understand that what's underneath that weight is a tremendous amount of pain.
Yeah, it would be like making fun of someone who is drunk. It would be like making
right.
fun of, you know, the crackhead on the corner.
Right.
No, people have sympathy for people like that.
Right.
We're the same way. I mean,
it's an addiction.
It is. And
yeah.
I reached 320 pounds at about 17. When I stopped using the drugs, I just used even more food.
Yeah.
So the weight really
right.
packed on. Yeah.
I've heard that from drug addicts. I used to work with heroin addicts, and they would tell me that when you stop using, it's like your taste buds go crazy.
Well, not only that, but I had all these outlets. You know, I had
right.
all these different ones, and now with no drugs, I really only had one
right.
that I was using, and so I like hyper-focused on the food.
Right.
And so I feel like when people see you, it's like we're wearing our disease.
Right.
But people don't see it that way,
no.
unfortunately.
No. No, because it's interesting because when I worked with those addicts, they would laugh at me when I would say, you know, I have a food addiction. And I would say, well, okay, you can laugh, but you don't need to take heroin to live.
Right.
But I need food to live.
Yeah.
So every day
it's a temptation constantly.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, okay, well, you can have this, but you can only have a little bit of it because
right.
you do. We need food to survive. But that's why dealing with this addiction, I can diet and exercise and lose the weight, right?
right?
But
right.
it's I got to get right in my mind.
Exactly.
It's my thoughts about food.
Mm-hmm.
I have an unhealthy relationship with food, but really it doesn't matter what I eat. I can overeat celery.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's the thought process
right.
behind my relationship with food. And I will probably never be, you know how they say if you're an addict, you're always an addict?
Right.
I will probably even, you know, as I start to have a healthier relationship with food, I will never be a normal eater when it comes to food.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I lost a lot of weight.
Congratulations.
Yes, through the years. Went to Overeaters Anonymous and But even today, when I get stressed, I can feel myself wanting that sugar fix.
Mm-hmm.
I usually don't go to it because I know the ramifications, which we're going to be talking about, nutrition and ADHD. But it's always there.
Yeah.
As any kind of addict,
any kind
alcoholic,
of addict. Right.
They always have that, you know, nagging thing that's at them, you know. So it's very similar. So, okay, we got off track.
I know, sorry.
Which is no ADD. But can you tell me about life after you got married?
Okay. So, and one of the things I was going to bring up about depression was a place that I've noticed and that I'm working on now, but a place that I've really noticed where my depression came out was in my career.
Right.
My jobs. You know, I've never really been able to hold down one job longer than a year or two. I think the one job I had where I had for 3 years in a row, like, that's the longest.
Wow.
And I've never been fired, but I've been embarrassed to go back after taking so many days off, either in a row or in a year's time, because I just couldn't go to work for whatever reason.
And so all those times, and this is long before I knew you,
mm-hmm.
that you were taking off days because you weren't – did you see that as depression? Or
I did not.
Okay.
I saw it as – I'm a free spirit. I just want to work for myself. I can't stand being under the thumb of the man. Like, that's how I saw it.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that everyone knew what was going on. Well, maybe not everyone, because I'm sure I wasn't entirely honest about how many days I was taking off, even with my husband at the time.
Okay.
But people knew that I was taking a lot of days. No one really ever said anything to me and brought it up, you know. Because I find it interesting, most people don't take that. I think one year I took 33 days off.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. 33 days. That's
wow.
a long time.
Yes.
Not in a row, but spread right. out throughout one calendar year.
So you know, saying that you were sick. And
yeah. Oh, I would make up all kinds of good lies. I mean, I even went as far as, you know, forging doctor's notes to try to, you know, make it but what's interesting is, like, I'm never sick.
Yeah.
You know, so these people would think, oh, she's been sick, but then she comes back and she's fine. But I didn't even see it that way.
Right.
But that was the depression side. And, you know, probably the ADD side, too, if I didn't realize.
Yes.
I've always worked, you know, in banking, accounting, financial advising, boring stuff for someone with ADD.
Yes.
I'm good at it.
But you're very creative.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, to sit behind a desk all day and do paperwork or do this or do that and not be able to have fun or be creative or have my own voice in it was difficult,
right.
you know. And so that plus the depression made it hard to go to work.
Right.
So that was always a constant struggle throughout my marriage. My husband at the time was luckily one of the great things that his father had instilled in him was hard work. He was a hard worker. He would go to work and he hated his job, but he rarely complained. It was like, well, it's a job, I get paid, it supports us, we get to have fun on the weekends and after work. And so he was supportive in that sense, where if I was like, hey, I need to find another job, this isn't working for me, he just let me, okay, well, you know, we'll take care of, well, you do the budget, you know what's going on, we'll be fine, I'm sure.
Right.
So, you know, and we were best friends. He was my best friend. So we did have a lot of fun together. I mean, we would travel and we would, you know, experience things, and we were growing up, and so we were doing all the things that you do when you grow up, and I had, you know, my partner to do it with. He was my best friend.
But was there true intimacy?
No. And neither one of us knew how to be, he didn't know how to be a husband, I didn't know how to be a wife.
Okay.
Our communication was horrible. And I've always been a seeker. So I was like, let's get help. Let's go. Let's figure this out together. And he wasn't really too into that. So we would maybe, I think a couple times we did go and see a counselor, you know, and then that would die off. Like, things would get better, and then we'd stop going. And so that was kind of the ups and downs of our relationship, was always like that. Things would get really bad to a point where I would be like, that's it. I've had it. Things need to change. We'd have a big blowout fight. And then he would, you know, change just a tiny bit, just enough to get by so that I wouldn't say anything anymore. And then eventually it would start all over again. And it was like nothing, you know, both of us were loyal. We were faithful. You know, there was never outside of our marriage relationships, it was, you know, loveless. It was rarely any intimacy, not just physical, but emotional too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm a deep person.
Yeah.
I think deeply. I feel deeply. And I wanted so badly for him to be that too, and he just wasn't. And so I thought, well, I can change him. Well, I can just tell him what I want, and he can just be that. You know, I didn't realize that you can't just become anything you want to be. You are who you are.
Right.
And even if he really wanted to be that person, maybe he just couldn't, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to be good friends. We always had, not always, we mostly had fun together. But, yeah, there I rarely felt really supported. I felt like I was carrying the relationship.
And also you were controlling everything.
I had.
Because I think this is important.
Yeah, I was extremely controlling. There was a time in our relationship where I was physically abusive. I was definitely verbally abusive. I felt that he couldn't or didn't want to get in touch with his emotions. And to me, I felt like, because I knew his upbringing, that they were too painful.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was avoiding it. I now think that maybe he just was unable to really do it. I don't think it was like he was hiding it from me. But at the time, that's how I felt. And so I thought, well, same thing I did as a child. If I can do anything, even if it's negative, to get a reaction from him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I was verbally abusive.
But you didn't get what you needed.
Never.
Right.
No. But it was almost like that little release was enough. You know, gave me the release gave me what I need to let it go for a little bit, and then I'd blow up again, and then I'd feel better after the release.
So let me just say something, because along the lines of emotional individuation that, you know, you've done and
mm-hmm.
I've talked about on here for a long, long time, what I noticed is with people that are immature, emotionally immature, what they do is they have a relationship with someone, and when that person doesn't react to something that they've said or done, pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a child,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
A little child who wants that cookie,
mm-hmm.
and the mother says no, and they keep pushing and pushing and pushing and throw temper tantrums
mm-hmm.
until they get that rise out of the mother or get the cookie or get whatever it is. That's when I talk about people being really immature
mm-hmm.
emotionally. We all look like we're adults,
mm-hmm.
but emotionally immature, it's those kind of behaviors that stemmed from years ago, because you didn't really get a lot of what you needed when you were growing up.
Yeah, I definitely did not.
Right.
Right. And it's interesting that the relationship I had with my ex-husband, very similar to the relationship I had with my mom.
Wow.
You know, and as far as me being the parent in the relationship, I mean, he was so easygoing. And he didn't really care what we did, where we went. I mean, there would even be times where we would get in an argument because I would say, there's got to be something you want to do. I really wanted to take the back seat. I wanted him to be stronger than me.
Just like you wanted your mother to be that way. Yeah.
I wanted him to be, you know, the man of the house, the husband.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to be the caretaker.
Right.
I didn't really want the job. Which is weird, because I was ready, willing, and able to do it.
Right.
You know, because I did want that control.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there were many, many times where I wanted him to take the lead. He was not capable of doing that.
Right.
but, yeah, I did not want to wear the pants in the family, so to speak.
Right. So you ended up leaving him 2011.
Okay, 2011. So, wait, what year is this?
The 14th.
2012? Okay, yeah, 2011.
Right.
We, there was an incident that occurred in August of 2011, and it was really just about trust.
Right.
Where, and something clicked in me finally, like, I had an aha moment where I went, this is never going to change, you know, and is that okay with me? If things between he and I stay the way that they are forever, is that okay with me?
It wasn't.
It wasn't, which is, it's interesting the way it progressed because I really didn't even think it through. It was just, I went purely based on emotion because that's all I knew. But yeah, so in October of 2011, I moved out. I moved in with my mother.
Right.
And I filed, you know, he reluctantly signed divorce papers February of the following year, and by August of 2012, our divorce was final.
So I met you, I mean, I had known you, but I really met you when you started to come to me around that time.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I'm going to say when I first came to see you, I think it was around January of 2012.
Right.
But it took me until about June or July to like really come on a regular basis. It took me about 6 months to get the courage up to do what it was that you said I needed to do in order to be a healthy person.
Right. Which is amazing because you were going through a very difficult time.
Yes.
And I was trying to get you to see some of the things you needed to see.
Mm-hmm.
Self-awareness
mm-hmm.
was a big one. And it was very difficult. And I was very patient in understanding that you would get there. I knew
yeah.
that you would get there. And it took time, but you really, when you bought into the process of mindfulness and emotional individuation, and I want you to talk about the letter that you wrote
yeah.
and all that, you have just... It's amazing. You're not the same person.
No,
you're
not at
not
all.
Not the same person.
Not at all. I mean, I don't even feel. Sometimes it's, I look back at on just the last couple of years, and I can't even believe some of the decisions I made or some of the things I said. Or no, I can't even relate to that. But you, I think I really honestly take credit. You know, I pat myself on the back
yes.
for what I've done, but. I think that God definitely led me to you specifically.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
your style of therapy, of coaching, works really, really well with me.
Yes.
I've been to a lot of different, you know, therapists before throughout my life, and I've always been a seeker, you know, wanting to try to fix the problems that I see within. But your style helped me. And yes, it took me, you know, a little bit, but 6 months is really not that long
no.
considering what I was going through. I mean, I was devastated by my
yes.
divorce. I didn't realize how much I depended on my husband
mm-hmm.
for my everything. I mean,
right.
my security, my confidence, my esteem, my livelihood.
Well, and the other piece of that too is that you had been together
yeah.
since you were children.
17 years since we were 14.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, you grew up together. So it was like even having a brother or a sister that you divorced.
Right.
You know, because...
And I was almost mourning, you know, I was 31 at the time. So I was almost not just mourning the loss of the relationship, but the loss of my future.
Right.
You know, I had so many dreams and ideas and hopes and things we had said we were going to do. And because really, we had just moved out on our own at 24, and it took us a few years to get... you know, out of debt and be at a place where we're making good money. And so we were just kind of starting our lives together as adults, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And yeah, I was very sad that this life that I so badly wanted and thought I was going to have, that the idea of it was gone, you know, which really honestly is good because
yeah.
I see that now it's good. But at the time I was devastated and my depression just got worse and worse and worse.
And I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about when we discovered that you really did have ADD. I mean, I remember when you first came to me and you were like, no, I'm not really sure. But then I would see, first of all, your creativity, your poem writing, your drawing, all that is
yeah.
just off the charts. And
thank you.
Yeah, you're amazing. Your creative mindset, like the way you speak,
mm-hmm.
all that. And I'm looking at all this and thinking, no, this person definitely has ADD, and it was the inattentive type.
Yeah.
But you began to see that, I guess, after we were working, and you came to group.
Yeah, it was after the group because I was able to relate to just about, not every story, but every person I could relate to in some way. It's different. Like, I would, to me, my idea of what ADD and ADHD was someone who can't sit still in the chair. That's not me. But once I understood what ADD really is, but I've been very fortunate that while now I am on an antidepressant for my depression.
Which we discovered, I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to say this so everybody knows that Reese has major depression.
Yeah.
It's not a dysthymia. This is major depression, and the fact that she's been able to get to the place that she's at is amazing. It's like all these people out there who hopefully are listening and are depressed, and it's amazing how you've risen. And I know you're on medication, and that's an important part.
But it's not the end all be all.
No.
No. What the medication does for me is almost stabilizes my mood.
Right.
So that I can deal with the depression.
Exactly.
If that makes sense. Because I woke up this morning. I had an incident that could have before very easily spiraled me down into that, and I would have missed a week of work.
Right.
But so what the depression does is keep my mood stable,
right,
and then I'm able to deal with the depression. And really what helps me the most is this mindfulness.
Yes.
The self-awareness, the not spinning with the thoughts.
Right.
These mantras that you help us.
Right.
The meditation. I mean,
right,
the exercise, the diet, there's so many other factors.
So let's focus on mindfulness for a little while, because we had Alan Brown come to group on Wednesday night, which
mm-hmm.
was great, and he did the Zen hacks and
mm-hmm.
talked a little bit about, ADD and their inability to kind of move forward in life. And so it's really interesting, and I love what he does. But one of the things that I truly believe is that, you know, years ago when I was trying to get organized, I would go and buy out Staples, all the organizational things I could get my hands on.
I love that stuff.
And then it would sit in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And what I came to discover in doing all the work that I did on myself was that it wasn't about the little things. It was about what was inside me.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk in group about doing the work from the inside out.
Right.
And that's what mindfulness is all about. And the neuroplasticity of how it can really change your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so many people that kind of look at me sideways and go, are you kidding?
Yeah, I did that.
But it does.
Mm-hmm.
And you are living proof of that. And I think what I really want to talk about is were you able to deal with, let's do the first step, because the first step in all this is self-awareness. So how are you able to deal with the fact that, yes, I am controlling, or, you know, other things that you knew about yourself, I'm impulsive,
yeah,
I have this. How are you able to do that?
Well, I first want to say that I'm incredibly grateful for the group that you do on Wednesday nights, because...
Thanks. It's a great group.
It is. And the books you've introduced me to, I feel like that is like a hands-on activity that has really helped me kind of put, you know, these tools, these practices, these things you read about, you hear about, to actually put them into play.
Right.
You know, and you give us homework, and I love that part, because it's like, okay, this week I'm going to do this one thing, you know.
Right.
I feel that obviously I was in a lot of pain, so I was definitely looking for answers.
Right.
I did not want to be in this pain. And I knew, I mean, I just logically knew that I played some part in the pain that I was experiencing. So I was at least a little bit open to, you know, accepting that, or at least admitting it.
Instead of blaming
else. Everything on my ex-husband or my mom or my
right.
dad or whomever. So I knew that I had it, but I didn't realize how much of a role I had. So I feel that, like, what the mindfulness part did in helping me be self-aware was, by being mindful, being present, being in the moment, I'm able to ask myself, what am I feeling right now? What am I thinking?
Right.
How is my body reacting to that?
Right.
That helps me be self-aware.
Right.
And when I'm sitting anytime, even if I'm distracted, I can know instantly now if something is hitting my stuff.
Right.
My thorns.
Right.
If something's a trigger. I feel it. I don't think I ever was still enough, quiet enough, present. I don't think I ever spent a day present in the moment.
I didn't either.
Mindful before this, ever.
Right.
But once I did, it was like I couldn't not pay attention to it because
right.
physically I could feel that energy. What do you call it when it's, the blocked energy.
Blocked energy. Because when your energy stops, you can actually feel that because something's hit your stuff or
right.
your schemas, the
right.
18 maladaptive schemas. Something's hit these things. Somebody said something to you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a judgment that comes up. Immediately, our energy flow stops. The energy flow that I'm talking about is not from food and sleep.
Right.
The energy I'm talking about is from awareness, sitting in the seat of consciousness. It's the energy in the body that is not related to outside forces.
Yeah, and
it's the psyche. It's the ego.
Yes, and to me, it's that feeling is like my soul is on fire.
Yes.
That heat.
Yes.
I had the lump in my throat, my heart pounding.
Frozen.
The
Do you ever
shaking.
Feel the fear and the frozen?
Yes.
Yeah, I used to get very frozen when fear would come up for me.
And with everything that I was going through, to be honest, the triggers were something as simple as, like, who just talks about the car driving by. You see a color.
Yes.
I mean, a song coming on the radio, a
Michael
picture.
Singer, yeah.
Just seeing people, I mean, every single thing was a trigger.
Right.
And once I sat in the moment and I realized that, I became really self-aware.
Right.
Ooh. And then I would hear myself. I don't think I ever heard myself. I would hear the way I talked to people, the things that I would say about myself.
Right.
I mean, it was just like...
Negative.
Oh, so negative.
Right.
I mean, even the positive things were negative.
Right.
You know, it was just, I had this story, and I was doing every single thing I could possible to make sure that I was living my story.
Right, because that's
that
where
I
you were comfortable.
Oh, I was extremely comfortable.
You weren't out of your comfort zone.
Which is, isn't it interesting, though, how as much pain as it brings, that was comfortable to me?
Well, they call it in therapy, they call it a thing called homeostasis,
mm-hmm.
and no matter what, we don't like change.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's the most dysfunctional life of all, we're going to stay in that place.
Yeah.
And because it's comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and it's not forcing us to change. And the other thing about people with attention deficit disorder is we really don't like change
because
mm-hmm. it's hard for us.
Right.
Because we're used to doing things a certain way.
That's true.
So from the mindfulness standpoint, though, because I had some people on Facebook today that were talking about sharing it with another page where there was a lot of anxiety. And what I've noticed, and I'm sure you have too, is that what mindfulness has really helped me with is my anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no OCD symptoms, and I used to struggle with OCD horribly.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
So now, for those people who are listening, I think to walk them through the steps a little bit, you know, to become self-aware. And I'm going to be I'm working on, Reese and I and Julio, who was on the show, couple of weeks ago, are working on a workbook that we're going to put out there, probably in PDF form, we decided, so people could just grab it.
Nice.
And do the work and start some other groups at the same time. So one of the things that is in the first chapter on mindfulness and how to do this is to kind of focus on an object. And I remember when I was first into mindfulness, and I really didn't know how to do this, during the day when I would feel my thoughts like starting to really get me. My negative thoughts would come up and I'd start spinning. I would focus on an object. I'd get up from my desk if I was working at the time and go to the window and look out and focus on a tree or if even so much as a bottle of water. To focus and to say and to repeat, I'm just going to stay in the moment. I'm not going to engage in this thought. I'm just going to notice this thought. I'm going to stay in the moment and I'm going to listen to my breath. And the breathing process is really powerful, as you well know, because your brain can't do two things at once.
Right.
So if you're breathing and your brain is focusing on the breath, then the thought kind of goes out.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea here is not to walk around empty, because, you know, that would be a Buddhist monk,
mm-hmm.
because that's what they do. That's not us. We're human beings. But the idea is not to engage in those negative thoughts that come up that freeze us,
mm-hmm.
just stop us in our tracks. The energy stops flowing, and we're done.
Mm-hmm.
We can't focus. We're procrastinating all over the place because we can't get done what we need to get done. So we're saying, okay, we're just going to go do something else. We're going to watch TV, or we're going to
mm-hmm.
eat something. See, this mindfulness is so powerful in terms of the negative symptoms of ADD,
mm-hmm.
especially emotional regulation,
mm-hmm.
where all of us can go up in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know I am pretty calm most of the time, not the way I used to be. I joke around because I'm still from New York. So I do have fun with, like, you know, playing angry or whatever. But I'm just not there. I still struggle somewhat with judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thing in mindfulness, too, is, you know, standing in line at the grocery store and there's a woman in front of you with 15 million coupons and you have someplace you have to go. And so I'm working on not judging that woman instead of just saying, hey, she's smarter than me because I don't have any coupons. So she's probably saving a lot of money and I'm not, you know? So, I mean, and just trying to make, like, laughing a lot
yeah.
is, you know, what my husband and I do, because we're both ADD, so we have a lot to laugh about. And we try to find humor in just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just think that for everybody out there, no matter who you are, this kind of work is absolutely necessary, and it's life-changing.
Yeah. Yeah, even people without ADD.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like everybody can use this
yes.
for some purpose.
Yes.
To do something positive, to make some change, to have some growth or
yes.
some healing. Every single person can benefit from this.
Yes.
And what mindfulness has really, really helped me with is not only being honest with myself, but being authentic.
Yes.
To who I really am, what I'm really feeling, what I'm doing. You know, I don't know that I ever really lived in the moment, and now that I do, I'm getting to know myself in ways I never knew before. I'm getting things done. I'm getting things done. Like, end of the sentence. I mean, my follow through. I was someone who would start something and never finish anything. I was telling you the other day, I have projects, even still now,
right,
that I had started years ago. I had, like, scarves I had half
or
knit.
Or paint by number.
Paintings that I had half painted, poems. I have tons of books I've half read. But now I embrace it and I say, number one, how important is it for me to really finish this?
Right.
If it's not important, then that's okay. I accept that I'm done.
Right.
But the stuff that I know I need to follow through with and finish, I spend my time and my energy on that as
right.
opposed to sitting there spinning with all of these thoughts. That takes a lot of energy.
And that's what happens to people with attention deficit disorder. Whether we're on medication or we're not, the medication is not the magic bullet.
Never.
Because the mindfulness for me really helps me to slow down
mm-hmm.
so that when I leave the house in the morning, I know that my phone is in my bag.
Mm-hmm.
I know that my keys are hanging in a certain place. I know that I have my lunch with me and books that I have to take with me, because when I collected that stuff, I was mindful when I was doing it.
Yeah.
Mindful being focusing on what I'm doing in the moment, staying calm, because I'm not exiting all over the place as I'm trying to get out of the house.
And where it helps me, because, see, I was never one to lose things or misplace things.
Right.
But where it helps me is, you know, remembering conversations that I've had with people.
Exactly.
Remembering my trip from home to the grocery store. You know, being able to engage with people and really be present and listen to what they're saying.
Right.
Instead of focusing on what my next thought is going to be, what my next comment is going to be. That
is huge.
That is how my ADD affected me. Never lost my keys, never locked them in anything, never left anything on. You know, that was not how it manifested for me. But I was not, very rarely was I present in relationships.
Right.
At work.
Right.
You know, if something was on my mind, I couldn't get any work done until I allowed that thought.
Wow.
You know, to follow through.
And the big thing you just brought up for a lot of people is being able to mindfully listen to another person. Because, you know, I remember even my oldest son, when he was a little boy, we'd all be watching a movie and he'd be asking questions. And my ex-husband, who had not a clue how to deal with any of this, he would get very angry at him for interrupting the family time.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, look, I'm going to give you a pad and a pencil. And as we go through the movie, write down the questions that you have about
Smart.
The movie so that when it's over, I can answer those questions for you. And that worked, you know. Well, it's the same thing. When somebody's speaking and I, even in coaching or therapy, and I'm thinking of something I want to say, but I want them to finish, I'll write that down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being mindful of listening, and usually I'm okay at getting back to that thing. But sometimes I write it down for fear. This is really important, and I want to say this, but I don't want to interrupt.
Right. Or even just remembering, you know, like when you and I talk sometimes, or when we do in the group, and we get sidetracked for a minute, I used to never be able to remember where I started and how to get back there. You know, it was like, well, what was my point? What was I talking about? That was what I would say all the time. Now, I may get sidetracked, but I know right where I left off.
Now, I want to tell you something. That's how you know, I swear, that neuroplasticity is working.
Mm-hmm.
Because before I got better working so hard with mindfulness, I could not remember. I would get so lost, off track.
Mm-hmm.
And today, if I know that I'm really, really stressed, that's how I can really tell, because I can't get back.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm present, I'm in the moment, that is an incredible sign that neuroplasticity is really starting to work.
Yeah.
Especially for us, because we cannot remember what we were just saying.
Well, yeah, and not only that, but I get distracted by pretty colors,
right.
You know, good-looking children,
right.
Certain conversations. Like this morning I was at a coffee shop and I was reading, and I was actually able to read with several conversations and activities and things going on around me I did get distracted once or twice. But for the most part, you know, I read a good 20 pages in a decent amount of time. And without getting caught up in everything, I was really able to, like, focus on what I wanted to focus on. That would have never happened.
That's amazing. Before. And you're not on any kind of ADD medication.
No.
Right. Okay. So what Reese did is she worked on emotional individuation.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, becoming an adult.
Mm-hmm.
The last step in that whole process is writing the letter to that little child, which I've done, and you're the only person in the group.
Oh.
Who has done that. Other people have not yet. David, I think, is getting there. Okay. David was on a couple of weeks ago. So I would like you to share a little bit about that whole process and where it's taken you.
Okay. Well, first off, you had mentioned to me that this was going to be something that I was going to do eventually, so I knew for quite a while that it was going to be something that I was looking forward to. But when it came down to, okay, I think I'm ready. You said, yes, I think you're ready. Let's do this. This is what we're going to do. It took me, a couple of months.
Yeah.
To really, like, actually write the letter and...
Well, you would start and stop, which was great.
Right.
Yeah.
And for me, at first it was, well, I'm just going to take my time because sometimes I'm feeling it, sometimes I'm not. But really, I think I was really resistant.
Yeah.
To allowing the mature adult in me to have full control,
right.
And let the little girl, who I call Reese, because that was my nickname growing up, to let her go to sleep. And I think the reason why is because she had taken care of us for so long, even when not great. It was just another relationship I had to say goodbye to, in a way, and it was another type of control that she had to release. It was just, it took me a little bit of time. But something happened in group. I wish I could remember what it was, but I can't. But I remember something was said or something happened in group, and it was like something clicked, and I went, you know what, I need to finish this letter. And I had made a decision that I was going to finish the letter that week.
Right.
And I did. I went home. I finished the letter. And it wasn't until I read it to you.
Right.
And then I took it home and burned it.
Yep.
That I really felt a shift.
Yep.
So
you felt that shift of growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt, and you know, part of it was, and I don't even really remember the lengthy letter that I wrote in its entirety. But
right.
Part of what I wrote in there was that I promised Reese that I was going to take care of her.
Right. And compassion.
I gave her tons of love. I apologized. I empathized. And I promised her that I was going to take care of her. And part of the reason why I think that she has remained so quiet and not had temper tantrums is because she really trusts me.
Right.
Not a lot of people have kept their word to us in my life.
Exactly.
But I luckily have a good, trusting relationship with myself that she was able to really calm down. And I don't feel that she has, since that day that I burned it, she has not come up.
No, no. And it's pretty amazing. There are all the steps involved in emotional individuation. So self-awareness is the first one. And then we did the mask, which is very interesting.
I love
because
that.
You, the front of the mask is who you portray to mm-hmm. people. What's behind the mask is really the self-awareness, because
mm-hmm.
it can be depression, anxiety, impulsivity, whatever it is. And then there are certain people who wear two or three masks
mm-hmm.
every day, which can be complicated. And then the genogram was really powerful, going back and looking at.
Which I'm still trying to work on.
Yes.
Because I didn't, you know, there are people in my family that I had lost contact with.
Right.
And you and I were just discussing recently, trying to mend those bridges and see if I can not get some more information about family history.
Which would be great, because I think one of the reasons we don't grow up, a lot of people ask me that question, why? Well, I think when you have mental disorders, that could be anxiety or depression, or anxiety, or substance abuse in a family, we tend to get tethered in our lives to people with those issues. And also on top of that, we, in our population, and I'm a lot older than you, but years ago, nobody knew there was an ADD.
Mm-hmm.
But all the things that we listen to, you're lazy, you're stupid, you're a procrastinator, all those things that I had to go through, and I went to God help me, Catholic school, okay, where I was put in a garbage pail for writing in script the night before Christmas in second grade. So, I mean, you know, all those kind of things that we went through kind of tethers us to our past
mm-hmm.
and to our childhood and our adolescent years. And so doing the genogram, we begin to see where these pathologies of ours have come from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add in that the 18 maladaptive schemas, which, you know, are across the board for everybody. I did not come up with these. I think it was Jeffrey Young who did. He's a therapist or a psychologist. And they're powerful. And for those of you who are listening, you can look them up online. And we're using them
mm-hmm.
at group right now. And just trying to release all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in the releasing process, we're able to look at life a lot differently, because when stuff comes up now, for me, I go, okay, I know what schema that is. I'm not going there. I'm okay with this. I've already dealt with it.
And I think one of the great things about knowing your family history is, at least for me, it's been being able to empathize with my parents,
yep.
have compassion,
yep.
Work on releasing that resentment,
yep.
and forgiveness. Because if I can see, well, what were their parents like? How did they grow up?
Well, I think one night when we were doing the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, because for those of you who are listening, we were doing Byron Katie Loving What Is book, which is powerful.
Love it. Mm-hmm.
And I did my father, right? And I said, as I look back, I understand that my father's father died when my father was five.
Mm-hmm.
He had not a clue what it was like to be a child. because he at that point had to watch his younger brothers while his mother went off to make money.
Mm.
So there's compassion there
mm-hmm.
for my father not understanding what it was like for any of us to be children. So he wasn't as patient and loving and kind and understanding as somebody else who understood that.
Right, right.
So yes, you're right. And having that, it's easier to release.
Yeah, and I think it also helps us not take it personally. As difficult as that is,
right.
To not take it personally. I mean, there are lots of things that I have done to other people in my life.
Right.
That had nothing at all to do with those other people.
Right.
It was about me.
Right.
And so for them to take that personally, you know, of course I'm sure they did at the time, but had they understood my life growing up.
And they probably
they'd
didn't.
See it, no, but if they were to now, right,
right,
they'd see it differently and not take those things I did or said personally because it had nothing at all to do with them.
Right. And we can only hope that people can do that because there are people that can't get to that place of
mm-hmm.
empathy, and these are very sick people.
Mm-hmm.
So after the genogram, doing that work, then really what comes is the releasing of the schemas. And eventually that letter is what really helps us to get through that resentment of some of our own childhoods that were so painful. I mean, some of the people in the group, their stories.
I know, I can imagine.
You were there for some of
well,
them.
Well, yes. And can I also just say that, you know I was skeptical, right? Because, I mean, I've always been into self-help, but there were some things that you would say in group or in our private sessions that I just went, I can't ever see that happening. Like, I'm open, I'm willing, I'll give it a try, but I just can't ever see that happening. Now, I knew what you had said about doing the letter, and one of the main reasons why I did it was because you told me to, right? And I'm entrusting, and I believe a lot of what you say I've seen the difference it's made in my life. So at this point, I really will just do, if you give me an idea, I'm willing to just do it
right.
And see what happens. I really was not prepared for how powerful of a switch it was going to be.
And talk about, for a minute, the crying.
Oh, the release that I felt. Because, you know, some of the things I wrote in that letter were stories or memories that I had that I had told people, but I'd never actually written them down.
Wow.
And I really do believe in the power behind writing things down.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do I feel that it is the only way that you can be 100% honest with yourself,
right?
Because you can't, it's fact and it's written, but I feel like there is a different kind of release that comes from just talking about it
right.
When you write it down. And some of those things I had never written down. And I cried so hard, my eyes were swollen shut.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
I bawled.
That's how
and
I did,
I
too.
Wept, and I mean, I cry a lot. I'm a crier. But I had never cried that hard in my entire life.
Interesting. I'm not a crier. I don't know why, but I just am not. I mean, periodically I'll weep at a movie, but I cry. I can't ever remember in my life crying as hard as I did the day that I read that letter
mm-hmm.
and then ripped it up.
Oh, for me, it was while I was writing
yeah.
it. I mean, I cried while I read it.
Yeah.
But I cry all the time. So to me, I mean, that is my release.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it, you know, any less at
right.
all. But I had never wept.
Yeah.
And cried that hard ever.
And that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, it was so amazing. And it took, that's why I think it took me some time to finish it, because that was the initial writing. And I
yeah.
think it might have frightened me a little bit. That was a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
And a lot of feeling for someone who has gone her whole life doing everything she can to avoid feeling anything.
Yeah.
So that was a lot. It was intense. And I think that's why it took me another month or so to finish it. I was a little bit fearful about going back. But once I did go back, it wasn't as bad.
No.
You know, and then I was really able to finish it. And, you know, once I get an idea in my head and I say I'm going to do it, I just do it.
And now I think that adds to the neuroplasticity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're an emotionally individuated person.
Yay. Do I get a certificate?
Yes. I'll have to make one up.
Yeah.
But I'll give you one. But, you know, it's so exciting.
It
right?
is. Well, it, one of the things that's the most exciting is that I, the growth since then, it's not taking as long.
No.
And I'm impatient, you know, and I, everybody, we want change. We want it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I'm still working on a lot. I'm not even going to say some things. I'm still working on a lot of things.
Right.
But my gosh, how now the growth, it's like it really is able to sink in. There's nothing, there's
isn't
nothing
it exciting?
The other night we were at group and there were so many people that were a little bit down about the work that we're doing. And I'm like, I think this is exciting because that means that this is the stuff we really need. I mean, this is the stuff that's really going to help us.
Absolutely.
And yeah, that makes me excited because I would really love to see a world with so much less pain and more peace.
Well, I want to tell you something too. One of the things I want you to start doing in a group is to really talk more about having patience in the process, because I know that a lot of people are not, and they're
I struggled with anxiety, which makes it difficult too.
And you develop that patience. I know for sometimes you'd come to me.
I was kind of forced to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but you'd come to me and you would be so upset about being lonely.
No,
and that
God.
Was your biggest thing. And when is this going to stop? And, you know, and I would always say to you, this is a process. Mm-hmm. And I know there were times you wanted to, I'm sure, punch me, you know, because I'd give you chapter 10.
You know, I never got angry with you, which
okay.
is interesting. No. But I was definitely angry at the process.
Yeah.
But you know what you just brought up, what's interesting is, so the loneliness is not there, but nothing's changed. I still don't have any friends, and I still don't have a boyfriend. And as a matter of fact, now I don't even spend that much time with my mother. You know, my relationship with my sister is at a distance, so it's like I've even kind of got rid of a little bit more, and I still
but you
don't
know,
have,
so you,
but
this
I'm
is,
not, that loneliness is just not there.
This is so exciting. So I've said this to so many people because it was said to me. I'm not that brilliant. My first psychiatrist, Dr. Strange, love it.
I know,
the name,
I love
right?
that name.
He told me one time, because I was crying to him about being lonely, and he told me that he was seeing a supermodel. This was back when I was on the East Coast. And if I had known who it was, I would be shocked because she comes to him every week and cries about her looks, that she's lonely, she doesn't think she's pretty, and I'm like... So he explained to me what he was trying to explain to me, and he taught me so many wonderful things. Loneliness comes from within.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can be in a room of 1,000 people, 100 people, 25 people, doesn't matter. The loneliness that you feel is from within here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about being around. So
it's not about being alone.
Exactly.
You can be with people or without people and still feel lonely.
Exactly. And so you are a prime example of someone who's done the work and still doesn't have tons of friends. Not that we need tons of friends. I never did.
Zero. I have no friends.
Okay. And you have me. I'm your friend.
Yes,
but
okay.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But the point is, I really believe that your growth began with that around Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we didn't even discuss that. That was huge for me.
The first Thanksgiving and Christmas you were alone.
I spent Thanksgiving Day, I spent Christmas Day, and I spent New Year's Day by myself.
Yes.
On purpose.
Yes.
I mean, I had two invites for Thanksgiving, but it just didn't work out.
Right.
I had to work the next day. And then on Christmas Eve, I actually had an invite Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, but I ended up getting sick, and I didn't want to bring germs. It was like God purposely was making way for me to spend the time alone. And then even New Year's Eve, I was supposed to spend time with – I was supposed to go to a party, and they canceled at the last minute because they got sick. It was just like it worked out perfectly.
Right.
And – you know, that time of year is when my depression comes out full-blown at its worst. And I still struggled. I definitely still struggled. But I made it.
Right.
I made it through. And I actually turned the day into a great day.
Yeah.
And just, even if I was feeling horrible, I'd embraced feeling horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But this kind of leads me to, you know, I didn't start off 2014 so great either. I was very depressed at the
right.
beginning of this year because my medication had run out.
Right.
And I had to stop taking it for a little bit. And on top of it...
And you didn't tell me.
Right, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm in trouble.
Right, you are.
But, and I also was, you know, physically I wasn't doing well, and
no.
I wasn't feeling good. I wasn't eating right.
Right.
I wasn't exercising, all that kinds of stuff. The last, you know, month, but the last 2 weeks, more importantly, have been amazing.
So stop right there, because I want to segue into nutrition, because
mm-hmm.
the two topics here were mindfulness and nutrition and your story. So I just want to give them who's listening a little bit of history. So I guess it was about a year ago now, almost a year, that Steve and I decided we were going to become pescatarians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we gave up all meat and dairy and gluten.
Yay.
And sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
the only thing
one.
We eat is fish for
mm-hmm.
protein, okay? And we're careful about what kind of fish we eat, because I know people tell me about, you know, mercury and all that.
Right.
I understand. But since that time, I feel like even above and beyond the mindfulness, I am even calmer and more focused. And the minute I cheat, if I ever do, it's like Montezuma's revenge in terms of not being able to focus at all, feeling sick beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
Thanksgiving, we hadn't eaten anything related to, you know, a chicken, a turkey, or a cow since, you know, March of 2013. And the boys were here, so we decided to have some turkey, and I thought we were going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like over here kneeling up by the couch, and
mm-hmm.
it was painful to digest that. So Reese is a vegan. You don't eat fish at all.
No.
Okay.
I started as a vegan in 2004.
Right.
But it was, 10 years ago, there wasn't very many vegan-friendly options. So I only did that for about 6 months, and then I became a vegetarian. And I've done many different versions of vegetarianism, but I've been a vegetarian basically for 10 years.
But here's something I want to talk about, because I think this is really important. A couple of weeks ago, Reese came to my office, and her feet and her ankles were completely broken out.
Mm-hmm.
And she had not been eating well.
Mm-mm, not at all.
You were eating processed food.
You can eat very unhealthy and be a vegetarian or a vegan.
Okay.
There are, I mean, you could eat mozzarella cheese sticks for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's
right.
Not healthy, but
no.
You're considered
no.
a vegetarian.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So she was very concerned, and the thing that really amazed me, and I've told other people this because you told me this, her psoriasis got better when she became a vegan.
Correct.
Because you gave up processed food and you gave up
the
meat,
red meat.
The red
mm-hmm.
meat, all that stuff. And so your skin started to clear up.
The best my skin has ever done my entire life was when I was eating at my healthiest.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So now in the past 2 weeks that you're back to really eating healthy,
mm-hmm.
spirulina, by the mm-hmm. way, for those of you who are listening, spirulina is an algae, and it's a form of amino acid,
mm-hmm.
and it's really great energy.
It has like five or ten times the protein than beef.
Right.
It's a good source of iron.
Right.
So it's got a lot of energy, and
it's a detox.
Yes, it boosts your immune system.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And psoriasis is an autoimmune disease.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
Wow. So for the past 2 weeks, you've been doing that.
I went completely back to vegan.
Right.
So I'm not doing even fish. No dairy, no eggs,
right.
Nothing from an animal or the actual animal. And I'm also doing raw, except for dinner. Dinner is the only time I'm eating cooked foods.
Right. And mm-hmm. she looks amazing. Amazing. Your
Thank
face,
you.
I mean...
Well, I noticed immediately my skin, because I've struggled with acne. We have really bad acne runs in my family. So as far as my acne, I mean, you know, even in my menstrual cycle, nothing, no problems, no breakouts. And it's only been 2 weeks. I feel better as far as my mood.
Yeah.
And that's what I brought up to you, and I went, wow,
yeah.
I feel this has really helped me fight depression.
Yes.
And yes, it's only been a couple of weeks, but it's been long enough to motivate me to keep doing it every day.
See, and the point is that I know that there's a lot of people out there who are very skeptical about this, but I can promise you, you've got two people here, and we're not pushing anything. We're not selling anything.
Right.
There's nothing to buy. We're here just to tell you that this actually works.
Right.
And for those of you who have autoimmune disease or have had cancer,
mm-hmm.
I mean, my husband, you know, had prostate cancer,
mm-hmm.
and he's been cancer-free since 2011, and I made sure that we were going to eat right
mm-hmm.
because I knew that a lot of it was the good and plenties that he was hiding in the car under the seat, you know, that he would eat in the afternoon. But I wanted to make sure that we were both going to eat well together. And the ADD symptoms, it's amazing how they're just so much better. They're better with mindfulness, but so much better when your head is clear.
Yeah, and I mean, there are other all kinds of studies. I mean, some you can do the research yourself and look up online. There are documentaries about how food affects our brain,
yes,
our skin, our mood.
Mm-hmm.
It just
have
it's
you ever
so
seen
powerful.
Super Size It?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, it's scary.
It's that food ink, there's one, there's another one, and that's all, that's even, you know, fruits and vegetables.
Right.
Just food industry stuff. There's another, I don't remember the name of this documentary, I just came across it one time on a movie channel, and they took three different schools, and they had followed what they were feeding them at the school, and how it affected or didn't affect their performance in school. And
wow, what's the name?
I don't know. I need to find it. And the school that had the best as far as even kids getting into trouble, behavior, not just educational, but behavior stuff too, were the kids that were being fed fresh fruits and fresh vegetables and not processed food and things that were low in sugar and, you know, good fats.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
So, you know, I really want parents that are listening, because we have parents that tune in too, where your kids are concerned. Look, I had two kids. I still do, but they're grown now. And my 26-year-old is very much into eating right. I mean, he knows, because with the bipolar, he really tries
mm-hmm.
hard to
That's
eat
good.
Right. And Mike's getting there. He does better than he used to. But the point I'm trying to make is, if you have little kids and you want to introduce them to a new way of eating, don't stop everything at once, because you're going to completely turn them off. Like, I know there's a lot of holistic doctors out there, and I believe in holistic. I go to one.
Too.
But I don't believe in taking kids off everything. Okay. Just take them off processed food. Just start right there.
Well, and you also have to think that, you know, our bodies become addicted to this stuff, too.
Yes.
So there's going to be all kinds of changes.
Withdrawals and...
Yes. Yeah, so there's going to be all kinds of changes. So it's better to go slow.
Yeah.
And with kids, you know, I know that there are finicky eaters out there too. They can't quite understand the benefits of it, perhaps. Maybe they just don't even care.
No.
It's better to do it slowly. But I think that it's probably one of the best medicines. I mean, it's what we put in our bodies.
Right.
You know, that's very important.
Right, and I, you know, work with a lot of parents who get so concerned about putting their kids on meds. And I understand that, because some of these kids are 6 and 7 years old, and that's, you know, that's young. But I'm not saying you shouldn't put your kids, because that's not where I'm going to go, because
mm-hmm.
I'll get all kinds of nasty messages. So
what I
am saying is that before you go to meds, I don't care how old, why don't you try changing a little bit of your diet?
Yeah.
And let's just see if it helps the focusing.
Yeah, I mean, I did the same thing before I got on an antidepressant.
Yeah.
I tried everything else. And when all of those things still weren't working, I said, you know what, for me, this is what I need for now.
Right.
And if I get to a point where I feel like I don't need it anymore, then that discussion will happen, and I will, you know, slowly wean off with a doctor, of course.
Right.
But I think everybody, you cannot mass diagnose. And everybody's situation is different, and I feel like if you've exhausted all other things, and medication is what is needed, then
right.
I'm all for it.
Right.
I just don't think it should be the very first
no.
thing you do.
And what I say to parents when they ask me when, I say when you feel like your child's self-esteem is really suffering, and especially when they're socially not connecting with other kids, because a lot of kids with ADHD are in your face. They don't understand space. Social cues are difficult for them. So when they get to that point, more so than academics, because, you know, we really are not going to spend the rest of our lives with a pencil and a book in our hand.
Right.
We're going to have to socialize with people. Put them on medication for that.
Right.
Get them into school and so that they can socialize and, you know, they're not being made fun of, which, you know, I am so anti-bullying, I can't tell you, but we can't be there 24 hours a day at school watching our kids. It's bound to happen.
Yeah.
So I think if they need that, like my older son, you'd have to peel him off the ceiling. I had to put him on medication because nobody wanted to be around him.
Yeah.
Because he was annoying.
Well, and you brought up something else. You see, I don't know why, so I can't say because of, but I was bullied. And once I got to a certain age, I became the bully. So
wow.
I've lived both sides of it.
Wow.
And my opinion is they're both victims.
Yes.
Whoever is the person, the
yes.
child that's bullied and the bully.
Yeah, because, you know, the kid that's bullying, I work with a kid who bullies, and I guarantee you it's because of the situation in the family.
Yeah, there's something,
yeah.
something, and it's sad, a little sad to me that there are so many organizations that help the children that are bullied, and there's not that much emphasis or attention on the kids that are doing the bullying.
Right.
You know, and getting them the help they need.
So here's something I saw in the news the other day that I just wanted to share. I thought was really powerful. And it was created by a young boy who was different and felt bullied, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bench that he had put in the school. And anybody who sits on that bench doesn't have a friend. And so
oh.
then everybody in the school knows that, so people go over to those children, like the other kids will go over. And one of the things that they said, and it made me cry, was that the bench is empty more than it's full because kids are going over. Older kids are watching out. So I think this
oh,
is a great idea.
Amazing. So it's a great way to show, hey, you know what, I need some friends without having to, like, say anything
right.
or go and make the first move.
Exactly.
We should do one of those for dating. If you sit on the bench, you're single.
That's great.
Everyone sees you, they want
to. I used to do that at high school dances years ago,
yeah.
sit on the bleachers on the side. But, no, I think it would be
That's
great for some of the
really
schools,
smart.
For people who are listening, some of the schools to just start something like that.
Yeah.
And it was started by a kid. I mean, this is what I love.
And he probably has ADD, right?
Absolutely. Or on the autistic spectrum, or both.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I mean. Our kids are so creative. Who comes up with that?
Right, right.
So that's why when I talk about my book, The Gift ADD Lamb, The Gift of ADD, you know, if you haven't bought my book, believe me, it isn't going to make me a millionaire. So that's not what I'm looking for. The reason I put it together is so that you, the parents or adults, and the children can look at this book and say, oh, my God, look at all these people,
mm-hmm.
these successful people who have ADD and
mm-hmm.
are so happy. You know, there's musicians in there, there's actors, there's writers, there's politicians, there's filmmakers, there's athletes, there's everybody. In fact, you know, the guy who won for swimming, Michael Phelps,
mm-hmm.
so my son is so funny because he says he's a friend of his on Facebook, so... Chris is going to try to get in touch with him. I want to see if I can get him on a podcast.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, because he's very open about, you know, having ADD, and I'd love to talk to him. I
mm-hmm.
think it would be so interesting. His mom actually got him into swimming because she knew he had ADD.
Interesting.
And look how successful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I just think everybody out there should really see this as what it is. It's a gift. And mindfulness for kids works
mm-hmm.
and adolescents as well.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that it is a gift. We just have to find the outlet that works the best for us.
That's exactly
and
right.
And once we do, we can use that, and we do the mindfulness, and we, I mean, it's like, it's never ending. The road is just, and it's not to say that you're never going to have struggles or that life's going to be perfect, but it's like once you find what works for you, what creative outlet works best for you, and you do it.
Yes.
It just, the results are amazing.
Yes.
And for me, it's been writing. And that's something that I've always done.
Which is great.
But I just, you know, at times in my life when I've been distracted, I am not able to write anything, where now I can write whenever I want to.
It's so interesting because when you release the fear, right, which is what you did, and you use the mindfulness, then you can be in the moment, and the creative side goes wild.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes out tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just such an incredible thing. It's so exciting. And you put this all together, you know, the mindfulness, and if you feel like your child, your adolescent, or, you know, the adults that are listening need meds, by all means, seek them out. And then you put the food on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eating the right way and starting slowly, even for adults that want to become vegans or pescatarians or vegetarians, they need to start slowly. I mean,
right.
To just completely change. I remember when we did it, we just dropped right into vegan. And for about 2 weeks, I wasn't feeling real good. Because,
yeah, I did it slowly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was typical ADD and jumped 2 feet right into it.
Just add something else, too? Because I know you're talking a lot about parents and children and stuff, and I just want to add, too, for couples.
Yes.
Because that's, you know, that's the stage.
Mindfulness.
If I had done this work, I can't imagine what my marriage would have been today.
Yep.
With, you know, and not just me. I mean, obviously, I feel like he would have had to, you know, do some work as well, but I am really excited for when I do get into my next relationship to see who I am in that relationship.
You're going to be the best person that you can be, and you're going to be with somebody who is absolutely an adult.
Yeah.
Because you won't settle for less.
I won't, no. But it's like going to be very weird for me, right? Because I've never really had a mature, adult,
healthy,
functional, healthy relationship with anyone, even friends.
Right.
So I'm excited to
yes.
see, you know, what is this going to even be like? A relationship with no yelling and hitting and cussing and name calling.
And it's interesting because this morning, and I've been working with this couple who I'd love to have them on, but I have to get them to a much better place. I've been working with them for about 6 months, and this morning was the best session we ever had. And it's all about I'm getting them to the place of being mindful when they're speaking to each other.
Yeah.
And staying in the moment, and they're not running to the past anymore.
I think that
all they
help.
Wanted to do was blame.
Every couple needs to do this
yes.
work together.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that it could save marriages. It could save families.
It saved my life.
It's saved mine.
Yeah, seriously. And I tell people that, and I think sometimes people look at me like, you know, I'm a little off-center or strange, but I have to tell you that book with the horse on the front cover, Michael Singer, The Untethered Soul, it absolutely changed my life, and it absolutely saved my life. And meditation. We haven't spoken about meditation. We've been doing a lot of meditation now in group on forgiveness
mm-hmm.
and compassion and kindness. And there's a lot of books out there on meditation, and specific types of meditation can be really beneficial when you're trying to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very easy to meditate. It's not difficult. You just have to focus on your breath
mm-hmm.
when you're meditating. And again, there's apps out there that you can download.
Those are helpful.
That'll be very helpful to help you get to that place of zen,
right.
as they say it. But all this stuff together really, really is the answer to helping everybody out there with the negative symptoms of attention deficit disorder.
And it takes time, so you got to be patient.
Very patient. It takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process, and you have to be patient. Don't give up. Keep going. If anybody needs help from me, I do Skype with people, so please contact me through my website, and I'll be happy to contact you back and set up a time. I'd love to help everyone with this. So we have to go. I can't believe it that 90 minutes went by. This was so great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So much for being on here, one of my favorite guests, so we have to have you back very soon. So for everybody who's listening, I just want to remind you again about the adult support group. in Torrance, California, Wednesday night, 7:30 to 9, the Center for Learning Unlimited, and 2785 Pacific Coast Highway. I'm going to sign off. Everybody, please stay in the moment. Have a wonderful Sunday, and I will see you next week. Take care.